Lillian dusted the crumbs off her baby bump for Leonard to lick up and let herself out. Mercy spent the rest of the day with a sinus headache and a mediocre novel. It was, by far, her best day of the week. On Sorrow's Day, Mercy argued with Steve Coopersmith, the lot manager of the Afton Lumber Company. When Mercy first took over Bird Saul and Son's clerical work after her mother sailed the Salt Sea, the family business could afford to pay for delivery from Afton. But the more Cunningham had cut into their business, the more corners Mercy had had to cut. Birdsall's had long since switched to picking up their order. Ever since Pop had his heart attack and couldn't join her anymore, Mercy had had to sweet-talk one of the foremen into helping her load the wood into the hold of the duck. Today, it was Steve. She decided to test out Cunningham's threat by handing Steve her lumber order for the next 2 months. Despair set in as she watched him shuffle his feet and rub the back of his neck. "Thing is, Ms. Birdsall, I'm afraid we won't be taking any more orders past the first of the year."
"So it's true. Ms. Afton is selling exclusively to Cunningham?"
"Sorry." Mercy knew that Steve had played no part in this, but she was livid at Afton Lumber. And right now, the face of Afton Lumber was Steve Coopersmith, whose long, dark mustache drooped in response to her indignation.
"Birdsall and Son has been a loyal customer for over 20 years. We were in the tannery and funeral business before Cunningham set up shop, and we've always paid our bill."
Steve cleared his throat.
"Late."
"But paid? And now you're selling to Cunningham and no one else? How is that fair? Have you bothered to consider what this is going to do to the rest of us on the western border?"
"It's not up to me."
He flipped through the pages of his clipboard as if there was something of burning importance there.
"But did you stand up for us when Ms. Afton told you about the deal with Cunningham?"
"No, I did not."
"Why?"
Steve gave up the ruse and met her eyes over the clipboard.
"Because I've got 3 kids I'd like to send to college, and if I can recoup some of the money I shelled out for a prepaid funeral package, you better believe I'm going to do it."
"We'll match Cunningham's offer,"
Mercy promised him, inwardly cringing at the note of desperation in her voice.
"And tack on an extra 5% off."
"Can you afford that?"
She did the math in her head. It wasn't pretty.
"Probably,"
she said. Steve gave her a pitying look. He meant to be nice, but really? It was the nail in her cutter.
"There are other lumber companies."
"On the eastern border. We're not going to be able to cover the cost of shipment."
"That's your problem, not mine. I'm sorry. Now, if you'll excuse me, I have a business to run, and last time I checked, you do too."
"But for how much longer?"
she called after him, and was gratified by the shameful hunching of his shoulders as he walked away. On Salt's Day, Mercy argued with her father and her brother. With Cunningham's threats verified by Afton Lumber, she was in a vile mood, so when Horatio delivered a stack of bills with nary a letter from her friend in sight, she felt like her skin might crack from the frustration building inside her.
"Why didn't he write?"
she asked the Bride of Fortune over and over as she salted and wrapped 2 bodies for delivery and 5 for the burial pits.
"Why? Why? Why?"
By the time she caught Pop following Zeddy in a tray of freshly baked chocolate croissants into the kitchenette, she was ready to blow.
"Dr. Galdames said no more coffee," she screeched,
yanking the carafe from his hand and staining the tiny yellow flowers of her blouse with a splatter of caffeine.
"And the pastries!"
She grabbed one from his plate and slammed it on the tray from which he had plucked it.
"Will!"
She took another croissant and did the same, sending shards of buttery lamination scattering across the counter.
"Kill you!"
She grabbed the remaining croissant and chucked it back where it came from, making a bigger mess than the one Roy had created by putting them on his plate to begin with.
"Easy now, Muffin." "Don't tell me easy now, and don't call me Muffin! This is a place of business! Start treating it like one!"
"You can't talk to Pop like that," Zeddy told her.
"And you!"
Mercy turned on her brother, pointing an accusatory finger at him.
You were supposed to help me stop Pop from doing things like stuff his face full of coffee and pastries. And here you are, encouraging him. Stop worrying so much, Pop stopped himself, took a breath, and continued. I can take care of myself. Can you? Can any of you? Because I've been taking care of everything and everyone for 13 years.
Except yourself, Zeddy muttered.
Why are you here? Don't you have something fancy and useless to cook?
Zeddy's eyes brimmed with tears.
You know what? Since you don't respect what I want to do with my life, you don't get to eat what I make.
He picked up the tray of croissants and stalked out of the building. Mercy stood still as a statue. She was afraid that if she spoke or moved or breathed, she would dissolve into a weeping puddle. Roy caved and put a heavy arm around her shoulders. After 2 weeks of the silent treatment, that single gesture broke open the floodgates inside her, and she burst into tears.
Who needs him? She wept.
And the sad truth was, she didn't need Zeddy, not when it came to running Birdsall and Son. What she needed was someone, anyone, who could pick up the slack around here. But one of those chocolate croissants would have been nice, too. She blew her nose, pulled herself together, and asked her father the question she had put off for too long.
Are you going to sell?
His eyes drifted. As far as Mercy was concerned, he should have taken in every aspect of the building and the business it represented. The dock, the boatworks, the office, the lobby, the stairs leading up to Mercy's apartment. Everything he had worked so hard to build over the past 2 decades. Instead, he stared at the front door, gazing longingly after an absent son who was probably halfway down Main Street by now.
Honestly, Muffin, I can't think of a single reason not to sell.
She felt like he had grabbed an awl from the boatworks and was now burrowing a hole into her heart with it. She slipped out from underneath his arm.
So Zeddy is a reason to keep the business going, but I'm not?
The business has been a burden on you long enough. You deserve better.
Well, I'm so glad you're the expert on what's best for me. You and everyone else.
She didn't give him a chance to reply. She marched to the boatworks. Whatever Birdsall and Son's future held, today, she had work to do. On Fortune's Day, Mercy argued with herself.
I'm going to write to him.
No, you will not.
What if something's wrong? What if he's lying in a ditch, mortally wounded?
What if he decided you aren't worth it?
I need a friend right now.
Then find one in reality.
But
have some pride, Mercy.
Pride? What pride?
She wrote the letter. On Bones Day, Mercy argued with Horatio.
Had another dreadful night, did we?
Mercy gave him a withering look.
I like you, Horatio, but sometimes I loathe you.
My, my. Quite dreadful, then.
She took the proffered bundle of envelopes.
I slathered on makeup this morning, so I know for a fact that to all outward appearances, I do not have bags under my eyes.
Not that mortals can see, no.
Mercy growled as she flipped through the mail, each bill crushing her hope.
Oh, now, don't mind a bitter old nimkillum, although you, too, would be insufferable if you had been demoted to a position of common postal carrier after centuries of delivering messages for the most divine beings in the universe. Do you have any idea how awful it is to be an immortal of such discerning tastes and to be cast upon the wilds of Bouchon?
I like it here. It's unpretentious.
What is there to admire about a lack of pretension?
Horatio shuddered. Ignoring the slight on her town, Mercy slapped the disappointing mail onto the counter and declared,
There's been a mistake.
How do you mean?
I should have received a certain letter by now. Did you lose it?
Horatio pressed the tips of his wing feathers to his heart. If he'd been wearing pearls, he would have clutched them.
My little button. When it comes to fashion and mail delivery, I am infallible.
She did not tip him. On Wisdom's Day, Mercy argued with Nathan McDevitt. Sort of. She went to City Hall to pay her stupid drudge drill violation before she wound up with a late fine tacked onto it. A familiar voice called her name in the vestibule, the two syllables bouncing off the marble floor and counter. And there was Nathan, his silver deputy's badge winking on his vest. He came at her so fast that Mercy thought he was going to hug her, and she recoiled. He pulled up short, started to extend his hand, then wiped it on his pant leg.
"Hey," he said.
"Hey."
"What are you doing here?"
She clenched her jaw in irritation as she held up the ticket between two rigid fingers, and was taken aback when he snatched it from her hand.
"I need to pay that."
"No, you don't. I never filed the paperwork."
He tore it in two, shoved the pieces into his pocket, and glanced around furtively. The first ray of light indicating that this perfectly awful week might end on a happy note seemed to shine through the large front windows of City Hall. Nathan kept his hand in his pocket and bunched his shoulders up to his earlobes, which were turning pink.
"I'm sorry. I was a real jerk that day," he said.
For a full month after she had found out about Nathan's cheating on her, Mercy had longed for him to come knocking on her door, groveling, apologetic, pathetic with longing. She wouldn't exactly describe him as groveling or pathetic with longing at the moment, but it was nice to receive an apology, for the ticket at least. She didn't know what to say. His cheeks went as pink as his earlobes, and he gave her a wry smile.
"No, no. Don't argue with me on this. I was a complete jerk, and I won't hear your objections."
"Thank you," Mercy said with a small laugh. They continued to loiter in the vestibule, neither of them knowing where to look. By now, Nathan's entire face was pink. Finally, he swallowed and said,
"I miss you."
Good gods. How long had Mercy yearned to hear those words? And yet, now that they had been said, she floundered, unsure of how to feel or respond.
"Any chance I can buy you a cup of coffee?" he asked.
Ah, she thought, he's angling for something. But then she realized that the thing he was angling for was her, and wasn't that what she had been longing for? She recalled Lillian's advice about focusing on the man before her in the flesh, rather than her letter-writing friend, who remained silent. At least Nathan was better than the tall, single, and extremely attractive Tanrion Marshall her sister had been talking about.
"Okay," she agreed.
Nathan pulled his hand from his pocket, but didn't seem to know where to put it.
"Really?"
"Yeah, sounds good. Where to?"
His grin straightened, and he looked less like a weasel than usual.
"I need to finish up a couple of things and clock out, but I can meet you in an hour. The Salt and Key?
See you there."
As she made her way to the Salt and Key to wait for Nathan, Mercy couldn't help but notice that she wasn't as happy about this change in circumstances as she ought to be. Since she still had her copy of Enemies and Lovers in her purse, she got it out to read while she waited. Mercy had brought it with her to the Little Wren Cafe on Warden's Day evening so that she could loan it to her friend. And she had planned to ask him what his favorite book was, and they could have gotten to know each other better through the books they loved. But her friend hadn't shown up, and now she had to figure out how to disassociate her favorite novel from a certain abhorrent Tanrion Marshall. She flipped to one of the most famous scenes, the part where Eliza Cannondale first realizes that Samuel Dunn is more than what he seems. Soon enough, Mercy was sucked into the story, the cafe disappearing around her as she lived and loved through the character's eyes, which was why Nathan's arrival took her by surprise, despite the fact that she had been expecting him.
"You never get tired of that book, do you? How many times have you read it?"
Without waiting for her answer, he handed Mercy a bouquet of daisies, which she accepted graciously, even though she had never understood the point of giving a woman flowers. Maybe it was because of her profession, but she had always thought it strange to hand someone a bunch of plants that were already well on their way to their ultimate demise. Then again, he was trying, and it was nice to see Nathan trying on her behalf.
"So how's your mom?" she asked him,
which led him to tell her a funny story about how his nephew recently lured a raccoon into his mother's kitchen with a freshly baked pie. At least, Nathan thought it was hilarious. Mercy thought it sounded fairly traumatic. From there, Nathan told her how his father was doing booming business at the new general store he had opened in Harrington, how his sister wasn't a very good mother, and how his nephew seemed to be turning out well regardless, a sentiment with which Mercy privately disagreed. He talked about some interesting cases he'd handled over the past few months, and how he was anticipating his promotion whenever Sheriff Connolly finally got around to retiring. Mercy's part in the conversation consisted primarily of, "Oh," and "Really?" and the occasional, admittedly fake, "Ha ha ha." As she listened to Nathan talk about his job, she thought of her friend, of all the questions he had asked her about herself, how he had wanted to know as much about her as she wanted to know about him. Nathan hadn't so much as asked, "How are you?" And he did resemble a weasel. "Listen, Merce, I know this has been a long time coming, but I'm sorry about, well, about lying to you." The air left her lungs in a whoosh. The hurt and humiliation of his cheating on her still rankled her. But if Nathan was ready to clear the air, she was glad to get it out of the way. "Cheating on me, you mean?" His face went from pink to scarlet.
"Yeah."
"And for blaming it on me because you were lonely when I had to spend so much time taking care of my father after he almost died?" He nodded slowly.
"That, too."
Mercy considered him as he squirmed in his seat, nervous and jittery but earnest. She could see he meant it.
"So, apology accepted?"
"Yes, apology accepted." He laughed and ran his hands through his sandy hair.
"Gods, what a relief! All these months, I didn't know what to do or say. You have no idea how hard it's been for me."
Mercy let loose an incredulous guffaw.
"I might have had an inkling."
"This is great! Together again! What time should I pick you up tomorrow night?"
"Tomorrow night?
The Founder's Day party. It's a date, right?"
Mercy realized that he seemed to be confusing her acceptance of his apology with a welcome mat back into her life. The awkwardness was so visceral, it seemed to pull up a chair and order a drink.
"Nathan, I appreciate your apology, but I don't think we were meant to be."
"What are you talking about? We're great together."
"We're not, and you deserve to be with someone who's better suited to you."
"We've had one cup of coffee, and you're already dumping me again?"
"Would we call this dumping?"
He wadded up his napkin and made a show of dropping it on the table.
"I don't get it, Mercy. What more do you want from me?"
"I want to be with someone who asks me how my day was. Someone who finds what I have to say interesting. I want to be with someone who thinks that, I don't know, that I'm kind of special. That's all."
Nathan puffed his lips as if Mercy had uttered the most unreasonable thing he'd ever heard.
"Thanks a lot," she said.
"I'm not trying to be mean, but come on. Life isn't like those fluffy books you read. People don't sit around mooning over each other. This is reality, and in reality, you find someone you like and that you're attracted to, and you get married and you have a family, and that's all there is to it. It's that simple."
Mercy sagged in her chair.
Maybe Nathan had a point. Maybe she was reaching too high and wanting too much. Maybe it was time to lower the bar and readjust her expectations.
It wasn't like the population of Western Bouchong was bursting at the seams with available men in general, much less available men who showed any inclination to go out with her.
Nathan took her hand.
"So, what do you say? Are we on for tomorrow night?"
Mercy almost said yes. The word balanced on the tip of her tongue, ready to walk the plank. But then she remembered something her friend wrote in one of his last letters. "I feel very strongly that you deserve a friend more worthy of you than I am in reality."
Maybe he hadn't shown up because he sincerely believed that he wasn't good enough for her. Maybe he hadn't shown up precisely because he thought she was kind of special. Mercy wanted a man who thought she was worth something, and that man clearly wasn't Nathan. "I don't think so," she told him. She took her hand back and stood up to leave.
"Well, I don't think so isn't no, so I'm going to hold out hope for us."
Mercy shook her head and left, wondering why he'd bother to hope for something he didn't seem to want very much. On Warden's Day, Mercy did not argue with Hart Ralston.
Chapter 19. On the morning following his disastrous showdown with Mercy at the Little Wren Cafe, Hart lay like a slug on his unforgiving hotel room bed in Mayetta, with the curtains drawn, waiting for Duckers to show up with his auto duck. He wanted very much to be unconscious and tried to spend the morning asleep. When that didn't work, he tried to read his newest interlibrary loan, Rabble Rouser, the Federated Government and the First President. But his mind kept drifting to Mercy and their letters to each other, and his suffocating disappointment. He tossed the book onto the side table and attempted to clear his mind of all thought, but turning off his thoughts transformed him into a pile of throbbing, painful, wordless emotions when feeling anything was the last thing he wanted to do. Checkout time rolled around without any sign of Duckers, so Hart was forced to remove himself from the hotel bed that felt more like his bier than a place of rest, and wait for his apprentice at the Little Wren Cafe, the place he least wanted to be. The only available table for lunch was the one at which Mercy had sat the night before, waiting for a friend who never came. He couldn't bear to sit in the chair he had occupied, so he took her seat instead, watching people come and go through the front door, which was somehow worse. He ordered tea and forced himself to choke down a BLT, his irritation with his apprentice ballooning by the second. The door chimes tinkled Duckers' arrival around 1 o'clock. His swagger through the restaurant indicated his unpardonable happiness. How could Duckers be so delighted with one birdsall when Hart was livid with another? "You look miserable," Duckers chirped as he sat down at Hart's table and plucked the pickle from his plate. "Order your own lunch." "I had a late breakfast of eggs Benedict with prosciutto and a blueberry muffin. There are serious benefits to dating a man who cooks." Duckers finished off the pickle and dried his vinegar-coated fingertips on the tablecloth. "So, about last night." "I give zero shits about your love life," Hart said, cutting him off before taking a bite out of a sandwich he didn't want. "I'm not talking about my love life, sir. I'm talking about yours." "Don't have one." "Whose fault is that?" "Don't want one." "Are you seriously not going to talk to—" "So help me gods, Duckers, if you utter that harpy's name, I will rip your balls off." Hart paid his tab, and he and his apprentice drove through the desert scrub to the West Station. When the squat adobe building came into view with the mist of Tanria shifting restlessly behind it, Hart felt his shoulders ease. This was what he needed, to get back to work and take his mind off the nightmare he had left behind him in Mayetta. But his shoulders tensed all over again when he checked the week's assignment board and saw that Duckers had been given checkpoint duty, while the words "report to the chief's office" were written next to his name. "Are you in trouble, sir?" "I highly doubt it," he told Duckers. But whatever it was, he was in no mood to do anything other than his job. 5 minutes later, he rapped on the office door, stepped inside when beckoned, and asked, "What the fuck, Alma?"
"And a good afternoon to you too, Marshall."
He dropped into the chair across from her. "Sorry, what the fuck, Chief McGuire?" She folded her hands over a stack of papers on her desk, as smug as a kid with an ice cream cone.
"Are you familiar with Legislative Bill B-27-TL-5?
"No, should I be?"
"Legislative Bill B-27-TL-5 passed last week and is effective immediately. It states that any federal employee accruing more than 200 vacation days must take the surplus." Do you know how many vacation days you have accrued in the past 19 years, Marshall Ralston, federal employee? Hart had no idea how many vacation days he had piled up, but he had a bad feeling about this. Well, I'd have to check my records, but... Alma held up one of the documents on her desk. 207. So enjoy your vacation. Hart was aware that most people looked forward to taking a vacation, but as 7 days with nothing to do stretched before him, the word itself spelled his doom. I don't want to go on vacation, he whined, literally whined. Tough shit, have fun. Denial bubbled inside him. All he wanted to do was lose himself in his job, and now he was going to have nothing but free time to fill with thoughts of the disaster that was Mercy. You're enjoying this too much, you cruel, cruel woman, he told Alma helplessly. Vacations are for enjoying. Enjoy yourself for a week, all right? He levered himself out of the chair and grumbled. Great, thanks. Oh, believe me, it is my pleasure. Hart left Alma's office and walked aimlessly through the station, winding up in the parking lot beside his auto dock. Maybe a vacation wasn't a terrible idea. Maybe getting away from the familiarity of Tanria and Eternity, and Mercy, and taking a long drive over the sea was the best way for him to get his head on straight. He filled up the gas tank in Harrington, picked up his holds at the library, and hit the road, driving west until he came to the Great Western Sea, after which he cruised up the coast for another hour before exiting onto Seaway 95, heading to the Inner Islands. There was hardly any traffic, and the Great Western Sea opened up around him. He draped his forearm across the open window and let the ocean spray cool his skin. If only it would soothe the burning inside him, this pernicious emotion he could not name with accuracy. Disenchantment? Regret? Whatever it was, it accompanied him like an unwanted guest in his passenger seat. He arrived on the Hunt Island by late afternoon. The beaches here were rocky, so it was the least touristy of the Inner Islands, which was why Hart had chosen it as his reluctant vacation destination. Most of the island was a federal waterbird preserve, so at least he wouldn't have to worry about interacting with people. He could be alone with his turmoil in the tent he pitched inland. As the sun set, he walked to the shore and watched the sea roll in and out, its whispered undulation like the heartbeat of the Mother of Sorrows. The infinity of gray-blue water reminded him of his friend's letter, how she had looked up at the night sky and felt a part of something bigger than herself. It wasn't a friend who wrote that letter, he reminded himself, with a fresh surge of the unnamed emotion he couldn't shake. Mercy had gone to her father's house that night and had touched her mother's key with salt water on her fingertips. Hart had no desire to emulate her. But as he watched the waves billow in and out, feeling adrift in his own skin, he dipped his fingers into the salty water and touched his mother's key over his sore heart. In the days that followed, he haunted the island like a ghost, wandering along the beach, letting the wind buffet him, tousle his hair, whip his shirt against his skin. He wanted to feel something, anything, other than the despondency that had taken hold of him and refused to let go. He tried to read, but he had neither the attention nor the appetite for books, and the more he was left to his own devices without his job to anchor his thoughts, the more his mind was free to go ferreting about the darkest places inside him. He had come here to escape from Mercy, but as the week trickled by and he did his best to push all thoughts of her to the side, he wound up slamming into his memory of Bill and all the remorse that came with it. He tried to grasp onto the happy times he had spent with his mentor, but as night crept in, it was Bill's death that gnawed at him in the darkness. By Wisdom's Day, he itched to go home, but he had no home. He thought of the mist swirling beyond the West Station and said to himself, "That shithole is your home." How sad is that? Regardless, he had already packed his bag, preparing to drive back to Bouchong early, when a Nimkilim cleared her throat outside his tent and announced, "Mail delivery."
A letter. Hart thought out of instinct as he stepped outside, and then his knee-jerk hope came crashing to the ground as he remembered, from Mercy. The Nimkillum, a pelican in a starched white shirt, opened her beak and plucked the envelope from the stack therein, presenting it to Hart with an efficient flick of her wing. Hart was tempted to find out what would happen if he refused delivery, but the magnetic pull of a new letter was too ingrained in him to resist. He fished in his pocket for a tip and accepted the letter. The words, "To a friend," were written on the front of the envelope, as they always were, in the same graceful handwriting he had come to cherish. He set the letter on his bare cot, sat on the other end, and stared at the unopened symbol of his unfinished business with Mercy. His whole life was like this letter, a series of goodbyes that never happened, a line from his past to his present that he could draw in his mind with a thick-nibbed pen from his mother to Bill to Gracie to Mercy. He didn't need a vacation. He needed to put the past behind him once and for all. Hart drove to Bouchong and sneaked into Tanria, which is to say, he entered through the northern checkpoint rather than the west station so that Alma wouldn't know what he was up to. He wasn't thrilled to discover that Saltlicker, his least favorite stallion, had wound up at the north station and was the only mount available. "Typical," he told the Equimaris, who gurgled in surly agreement. He rode south to Sector W43, worried that he wouldn't be able to find Gracie's grave after more than 4 years. But as it turned out, he could never forget where he'd buried her. The stone cairn was still there, though not as tidy as he had left it. At least the untidiness was the result of the ground shifting over time, not scavengers trying to dig their way in. He pictured his dog in his mind, her liquid brown eyes, her crooked ears, her mouth a smile outlined in black fur. He remembered the bristly texture of her fur beneath his hand, the way she snorted in her sleep, and his tears welled up, strong and fast. Out here, where no one could see him, he let them fly. "Well, Gracie," he said with a sad, shaky laugh, "I was a mess before, but I've made a pig's ear of my life since he left me." If she had been alive, she would have flopped down beside him and propped her head on his thigh and sighed as he stroked her between her adorable ears. He pulled a handkerchief from his pocket and blew his nose before patting the stones over Gracie's grave. It was not as hard as he had thought it would be to say goodbye to her. Or rather, his farewell to his dog came with as much comfort as bereavement. He didn't anticipate the same catharsis for his next stop. He remounted Saltlicker and rode to the ridge overlooking Sector 28, with nothing but the slap and suck of the Equimaris' webbed feet against the pink mossy earth to keep him company. Below him, the whitewashed farmhouse with the blue front door sat in the center of a blanket of ruddy grasses and gray wildflowers, the house that no one but Hart could see. Dozens of souls, again something no one else could see, drifted nearby. He had known that he could see human souls long before he came to Tanria. By the time he was 8 and watched his grandfather's spirit leave his body, he knew that he was different in a way that was somewhat good, but mostly not so good. After that, Mom was all he had, the two of them living in the old house with a blue door in central Arvonia. The same house that, inexplicably, stood below him in this field in the middle of Tanria. When Hart was 18, and he and Bill had come across this field for the first time, when he saw his own house here in Tanria, a house that Bill could not see, he told his mentor everything about the house and the souls. A year later, Bill died because of it. That was why Hart stood here now, overlooking the spot where he had watched Bill's soul depart his body, where he had done more than simply watch. Hart did not think he was the offspring of one of the death gods. Most demigods displayed gifts that had nothing to do with their divine parent. Alma was a perfect example. Her mother was a water spirit, but her gift was the ability to start a fire and snuff it out again with her bare hands. And yet while Hart's parentage remained a mystery, His gift did not. He could see the souls of the departed, and once he had watched one of those lights, Bill's light, open the door to that house in the middle of Sector 28 and go inside. During his time with the Tanrian Marshals, Hart had saved many lives, but none of them counterbalanced what had happened to Bill. Everything about Bill was unfinished business, and Hart had no idea how to go about finishing it. He didn't think he could. All he could do was stand here and make himself stare at the spot where his beloved mentor had lost his life, because of Hart. The western sky turned orange, then pink, then indigo, but Hart stayed put, reluctant to leave this place for once. He picketed the stallion, taking pains to secure the reins so the stubborn asshole wouldn't abandon him to go off in search of water. Then he built his campfire and brewed a pot of strong black tea and heated up a tin of beans and ate some canned peaches, the same meal he had eaten with Bill countless times. He had said goodbye to Gracie, and he had at least tried to put to rest his guilt over Bill's death, albeit unsuccessfully. Now it was time to bid one more adieu. He sat on his heels and dug around in his rucksack for the packet of letters, bundled together with twine. "A relationship made of letters makes us little more than paper dolls," she had once written. And she was right. Their friendship had been nothing more than paper, and paper burned with ease. He held the letters over the fire and was about to drop them into the flames when he realized that Mercy's last letter remained wrinkled and unopened in his pocket. "Don't read it," he told himself. "Let it burn and be done with it." But he reasoned that he ought to bundle it in with the others so that he could toss them into the flames all at once. He undid the twine, meaning to do just that. But some force that was in no way related to his brain caused him to reach instead for the first letter Mercy had written to him. He read it, even though he already knew the words by heart.
"Dear friend, apparently I exist, because your letter has found me, although I don't know how or why."
It read differently this time. Now he heard Mercy's voice in his head, her musical manner of speaking, the way the words flew up and down the spoken register as if she were singing. He read the next letter, and the next, and Mercy filled his head like a symphony in a concert hall.
"A tiny part of me does want to know where you work, what you look like, how old you are. You see, I refuse to lie to you, because those things are a part of who you are, too."
He couldn't stop himself. He was like a thirsty man with a fire hose. Every letter was Mercy's voice, Mercy's words, Mercy in a yellow dress, Mercy with sawdust in her hair, Mercy holding a mug of coffee, splash of milk, no sugar. Mercy, who had lost her mother too. Mercy, who smiled at everyone but him.
"I have faith that our friendship can exist beyond these letters, despite all the faults and weaknesses of our flesh and blood selves, which is why I want to meet you, to know you better."
He saw her sitting alone at a table, watching the door of the Little Wren Cafe, waiting for a friend who never showed up. Except he had shown up. She simply hadn't seen him. And had he really seen her? For years, he had convinced himself that she was fake, that no one who worked with the dead for a living could be so alive and contented, that no one in general could put that much life and joy into the world. But these letters in his hands were real. And those dimples were real, and that woman who looked death in the eye but still found a reason to sing in the bathtub was real. And he wanted to know her better, no matter the faults and weaknesses of her flesh and blood self. He was beginning to believe that she didn't have as many as he had thought, while the gods knew he had more than enough faults and weaknesses for the both of them. He pulled her last letter from his pocket and opened it.
"Dear friend, I have something to tell you. My name is Mercy Birdsall. I'm very tall, and not in the willowy way. I have dark brown hair and olive skin and brown eyes, and I wear red glasses. My favorite color is yellow. I wear it a lot. I'm an undertaker, or at least, I have been for the past few months. I salt bodies and wrap them in sailcloth and sing the incantations over them. I build boats for the dead and send them where they need to go. I love what I do, helping souls find rest in the house of the unknown God and comforting the living in the process. My father's name is Roy. My sister's name is Lillian. My brother's name is Zeddy. My brother-in-law is Danny. Lil is about to have a baby, and I'm so excited about it I can hardly see straight. I love them all more than anything in the world. I don't know why you didn't come to the Little Wren Cafe last Warden's Day. So now I'm trying to show you who I am the only way I know how. And you can decide for yourself what you think of me. The real me. Because I want to know the real you. Even if we can't meet in person, I want to know who you are, your name, what you do, what you look like, what you care about, who you love. Forgive me if this sounds cruel or harsh or demanding, but if you can't bring yourself to tell me your name or to show your true self to me, please don't write back. Because anything less isn't true friendship. Sincerely, Mercy. P.S. I miss you.
Heart stared at her name, at the way she put herself out there, risking the pain and rejection that might come along with it. Did he have the courage to stand in front of her and say, "This is who I am"? The prospect sounded terrifying. But then he read the postscript again, and it echoed inside him until he didn't know if it was Mercy's voice or his own saying the words.
I miss you.
He missed her. He missed Mercy Birdsall, who had somehow miraculously become his friend. He took out a pen and paper from his pack, but put it away as quickly. Mercy deserved an answer, and a letter would no longer suffice. Hart expected to toss and turn as he camped out under the stars with a pistol crossbow under his pillow. But he slept soundly. The following morning, he took one last glimpse at the field below and murmured, "I'm sorry, Bill," before he packed up and rode Saltlicker to the portal at the North Station with the morning sun and the determination to finish some unfinished business lighting his way. Chapter 20. It was an hour's drive from the North Station to Eternity, so Hart should have had ample time to consider what he wanted to say to Mercy. But by the time he turned off onto the exit, he was a nervous wreck, and the fact that there wasn't a parking space to be had anywhere near Birdsall and Son did nothing to assuage him. The reason for this predicament became clear when he saw the banner stretched over Main Street. "Mayor Ginsburg courteously invites you to celebrate Founders Day, 25 years of eternity. Petting zoo, Equimaris rides, barbecue dinner, dancing under the stars, fireworks display." Hart cursed his bad luck. If Birdsall and Son was closed, he'd have to wait until after his next 2-week shift to talk to Mercy, which sounded like an excruciatingly long time. He caught his reflection in the rearview mirror and rubbed the stubble he should have shaved off this morning. There was nothing he could do about it now, but he could at least comb his hair. He did his best to make himself presentable and got out of the duck before he could lose his nerve. The crowded boardwalk made him feel like a cow in a cattle pen on his way to the slaughter. The sounds of children squealing atop miniature equimaries and the bleating of goats and sheep at the petting zoo added to the doomed livestock effect. He'd barely taken 3 steps in the direction of Birdsall and Son when the city hall bell began to ring, and everyone around him froze. The cacophony of moments ago evaporated. All but the goats and sheep went silent. "A drudge drill? Now?" a gangly boy whined. But his mother grabbed his hand and shushed him. "It's not a drill!" Shrieks and cries from somewhere down the street pierced the air, and Hart's years of experience in the Tanrian Marshals kicked in. He sprinted to his duck for his belt, and strapped it on as he ran toward the commotion. "No running!" someone shouted at him, but he paid no attention. Seconds later, he spotted the rogue drudge, badly decayed, shambling down Main Street on the next block, heading straight for a woman who stood on the curb outside Birdsall and Son, her yellow skirt like a bright beacon on the dusty street. Mercy. He surged forward, drawing the pistol crossbow from his belt. The drudge was 7 feet in front of her when he took his first shot, knowing the odds of hitting its appendix were slim to none at this distance. It paused as if it were confused. Then it refocused its attention on her and limped closer. 6 feet. 5. It lunged. "Please," Hart prayed to any god who would listen, and he fired. The drudge jerked, then collapsed at Mercy's feet. Hart ran as fast as his long legs would carry him, as the amber light of the soul that had possessed the body oozed out of the wound and soared toward Tanria. Seconds later, Hart was standing over the drudge, unsheathing his rapier and jabbing down and down and down until he was beyond certain the thing was dead, and he rolled it away from Mercy with the heel of his boot. She stood unmoving in front of him, but her eyes were alive with terror, boring into his. The bell was still ringing when Hart dropped his weapons and reached for her, taking her face into his trembling hands. Mercy. Her name was a sob in his mouth. Her eyes drifted to the body in the street. "Did it hurt you?" Hart asked her. Begged her. She met his eyes again and shook her head. Hart realized that he was touching her face and snatched his hands away, his emotions a turbid mixture of embarrassment and fear and relief. He turned away from her to see if there were any more drudges on the loose, but Mercy grabbed frantically for his arm, as if she were terrified that he would leave her. He stiffened awkwardly beneath her touch, then placed what he hoped was a comforting hand over her chilled fingers. "It's okay, I promise." Her face remained ghastly colorless, but she nodded and released him. He turned toward the street, taking in the slain drudge, the gawking onlookers, and 2 deputies running toward the scene. One of them put a possessive hand on Mercy's upper arm once he'd reached them and said, "Mercy, what happened?" Hart's vision went red. "You call yourselves deputies? How the fuck did you manage to let a drudge shamble halfway down Main Street?" The second deputy panted over the corpse before he answered. "We've never had a drudge in eternity before. We're nearly 15 miles from the Tanrian border. I don't know how it could have gotten here." The first deputy was calmer and more professional, but he still had his hand on Mercy's arm. Hart stared at the spot where skin met skin and felt very strongly that this man needed to stop touching Mercy, now. He gritted his teeth as Deputy Hansey explained the situation. "We had a report that there was a drudge on the loose at Clem Crenshaw's farm, a 1/2 mile outside of town. A rogue drudge sighting around these parts generally turns out to be a drifter or a kid playing a prank. But we always take this sort of thing seriously." "It was a drudge right there in Crenshaw's cabbages," the other deputy cut in. "Dead as dead can be, waltzing around in broad daylight. We took it down, then went to Cunningham's to arrange for its collection. But we got the appendix, I know we did." "Obviously you didn't," Hart snapped, his tone so sharp, he was surprised the men weren't bleeding. By now, the sheriff had jostled his way through the crowd. "Brewer, McDevitt, get this cleaned up, and then you can explain yourselves in my office," he ordered his deputies. "And the body goes to Birdsall and Son, not Cunningham's," Hart added. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw Mercy put a hand to her cheek and sway on her feet. He caught her under the elbow before her knees gave out, since Deputy Hansey wasn't paying attention and nearly let her fall over. "Hey now, Merciless, you're all right," he told her softly.
And I was..."
Her words sounded like they were being pressed through a laundry mangle. "Come on, let's get you inside." "I'll take her," the man with his hand on Mercy volunteered. And Hart wished there were dragons in Tanria so that he could chop off this incompetent asshole's arm and feed it to one of them. No, I'll take her. You do your job. The man shrank away, leaving Hart free to usher Mercy home.
You're going to have to file a report, Marshal, the sheriff called after him.
I'll be down after I see to Miss Birdsall. He didn't wait for permission to escort her to the front door of Birdsall and Son, which was blessedly unlocked. He got her into the lobby and deposited her into one of the armchairs. Leonard hopped off the neighboring chair and leaped onto her lap.
Mr. Birdsall, Hart hollered as he pushed the dog to the floor.
Roy Birdsall stuck his head out of the office, his glasses propped perplexingly on top of his eyebrows, and Mercy burst into tears at the sight of him. Hart nearly dropped to his knees to comfort her, but then he remembered that he had no right to do any such thing, and Roy beat him to the punch anyway, his knees popping as he knelt beside his daughter.
Muffin, what happened?
Not wanting to be an interloper, Hart made his way to the kitchenette and made himself useful. He could hear Mercy spilling the whole story in a sob-filled storm to her father as he put on the kettle and dug through the well-ordered cabinets. He found a mug, a tin of black tea, a jar of honey, and a bowl of lemons. Leave it to Mercy to keep lemons on hand in case a squeeze in a cup of tea or a glass of water might bring someone comfort. He could not erase the image of her standing on the curb, her lemon-yellow skirt fluttering in the wind as he fired the second shot the moment he thought he had already failed. The kettle began to whistle. Pull it together, he told himself, gripping the edge of the countertop. When he was steady enough to take the kettle off the hob, he poured the steaming water over a tea bag, after which he stuck his head into the lobby, directing his gaze at Roy.
Birdsall, got any whiskey?
Roy glanced guiltily at his daughter before answering,
My desk in the office, bottom drawer at the back.
Hart's hands wouldn't stop shaking. Thank gods he had something useful to occupy them. He found the illicit whiskey bottle and poured a healthy dollop into the steaming cup of tea and honey and lemon juice in the kitchenette, Bill's recipe for medicine. Hart was tempted to pour two or three fingers of whiskey for himself, but thought better of it. Mercy was the one who needed comfort right now, not him. He brought the cup into the lobby and helped Mercy to wrap her fingers around the handle, making sure she had a good hold on it before he let go.
Drink up, but take it slow, he advised her,
his voice alien and calm, mismatching the cyclone inside him. Oh, she cheeped in surprise after the first drink. Hart watched the colors seep back into her cheeks and lips with each sip, but then he had to resign himself to the fact that he no longer had a legitimate reason to stay. He would have to come clean about the letters another time.
I'll get out of your hair. You're all right?
Honestly, I'm not sure, Mercy answered weakly.
For the first time in over 4 years, Hart saw something other than hate in her eyes, which made his chest bloat with a painful yet oddly pleasant ache.
You will be, he assured her,
and he left before Roy felt the need to creak to his feet or shake his hand. Hart felt jittery as he headed for City Hall to find the sheriff's office. He needed to file a report about the Drudge incident, but every stride that took him away from Mercy felt like a step in the wrong direction. There was nothing for it, however, so 10 minutes later, he sat across from Sheriff Connolly at a dinged-up metal desk, jiggling his feet, wishing he could be alone with his thoughts for a few minutes. He answered the sheriff's thorough questions and was unspeakably relieved when the man finally set down his pen and said,
I think I've got all I need, Marshal. I'll be in touch if I have more questions for you.
Hart practically shouted, Thank you, as he leaped to his feet to escape. The sheriff got to his feet, too, and shook Hart's hand, but he didn't let go right away.
How do you like marshaling?
It's a living.
Hart glanced down at the handshake that would not end.
Is it a living? Because it seems to me there's a lot of dying involved.
The sheriff released his hand, and when he spoke again, his tone was casual and chatty.
Around here, we deal with petty theft, grievances, public safety, that kind of thing. but our primary focus is on service to the community. We work reasonable hours, our deputies go home at the end of their shifts, and spend time with their friends and family. Don't suppose you'd consider a move from federal to local law enforcement? So this was recruitment. It felt strange to be courted, but at least it was a welcome distraction from the confusion and fluster of his heart. "Hadn't crossed my mind," Hart said. "Your experience would be welcome here, and you could do a lot worse than settling down in a place like Eternity. You think about that." The sheriff slapped Hart on the shoulder in friendly dismissal. "I will, thank you." By the time Hart stepped out into the glaring sunlight, his boots clomping on the boardwalk, he didn't know which way he should be heading. The fact that another drudge had escaped Tanria, probably through a pirated portal, should have inspired him to return to the station to investigate. Plus, he needed to get ready for work in the morning. But he badly wanted to see Mercy before he left. Wanted to talk to her one more time. Wanted to make sure she was okay. And as he read the banner advertising the Founders' Day celebration, he was pretty sure he knew where he could find her tonight. A sudden wave of nausea overtook him. He turned and stumbled through the City Hall lobby again and careened into the men's room. The faucet handle squeaked as he turned on the tap. He cupped his hands under the stream and splashed cold water on his face until the nausea subsided, and he turned off the tap with another rusty squeal. The hand towel he clutched to his face smelled faintly of bleach, but he kept it there longer than was necessary, because he already knew what he would see in his reflection in the mirror over the sink. He hung the towel on its peg anyway and looked himself in the eye. There it was, a truth so evident that it may as well have been painted on his forehead in red letters. He was helplessly, boundlessly, stupidly in love with Mercy Birdsall.
Chapter 21. A near-death experience was all it took to make Mercy's family forgive her for keeping secrets, as Zeddy illustrated when he tackled his sister on her settee. "Get off her, you oaf!" Lillian scolded him, only to crush Mercy herself as soon as she'd shoved their brother onto the floor. "I think they're glad you're alive," said Danny, eating a slice of the coconut cake that Zeddy had brought over. "I won't be alive for much longer if Lil doesn't get her pregnant butt off me." "Is that a fat joke? Rude." Normally, the Birdsall family would gather at Pop's house for a special occasion, such as a celebration of the fact that Mercy had not been murdered by a drudge. But today, everyone came to Mercy, crowding into her apartment like sardines in a can. She thought of her friend lamenting the fact that he was lonely, when at this moment, she wanted nothing more in the world than to be alone. While every Birdsall but Mercy ate cake and filled the small parlor with talking and laughter, she sneaked into the bathroom for respite. Sadly, Pop's prostate had demands, and soon enough, he was knocking on the door and asking, "Almost done in there, Muffin?" The second she came out, Lil sidled up to her as Danny and Zeddy discussed various ways to prepare egg dishes. "How does it feel to have your life saved by your nemesis?" she asked, arching an eyebrow suggestively as she jabbed a huge bite of cake into her mouth. "I haven't given it much thought," Mercy lied. In fact, she could think of nothing else. Her brain was now entirely dedicated to the expression on Hart Ralston's face when he'd reached her. The intensity that had been drawn in every line and muscle. The way he'd touched her cheeks, his fingers hot against her skin. It was as if he had ceased to be heartache and had become someone else entirely. It was all so disorienting. "I don't think I'm up for the Founders' Day party tonight," she told Lil. "Pish! It'll get your mind off everything. Dr. Lillian says so." Dr. Lillian was relentlessly persuasive. And after a half hour of her sister's wheedling, Mercy caved and let her family drag her across the street to the festivities. But while the Birdsalls arrived as a group, they quickly scattered to the winds. Pop was immediately summoned to sit at the table with the men who argued about sea polo without ceasing. Zeddy threw his arms around two friends from school and whisked them away to the bar. Lillian and Danny headed straight for the buffet table, where Danny held two plates so that his wife could heap a staggering amount of fried chicken and potato salad onto them. Abandoned and alone, Mercy was defenseless against her neighbors and acquaintances, who stopped her every step along the way to the buffet table, begging her to recount the Drudge attack again and again. If Dr. Lillian had believed that being here tonight would take Mercy's mind off her near-death experience, she had sadly misdiagnosed the situation. Eventually, Twyla Banneker came to Mercy's rescue, handing her a paper plate loaded with food.
"I'd ask you how you're doing, but I suspect half the town has already made you recount every harrowing detail of your ordeal. That about sums up my evening so far. I sent Frank to get you a drink and told him that he wasn't allowed to talk to you about anything other than the weather. Bless you." Twyla Banneker and Frank Ellis were Mercy's favorite marshals. Middle-aged and down-to-earth, they were partners in Tanria and next-door neighbors in Eternity. The sort of best friends who came as a matching set, as if they were attached by hyphens, Twyla and Frank. Mercy tucked into her pasta salad as she awaited her drink, but nearly choked on the macaroni when she noticed Hart Ralston's unmistakable form looming at the edge of the gathering. Her mind whirred into a panic. Should she talk to him? Thank him? Hide under a rock? Hug him? No, she definitely should not hug him.